I always knew that if I ever heard those beeps and had a live microphone and an engineer pointing a finger at me, I'd lose not just my nerve, but my voice. I'll bet you this voice loss is not laryngetic. I'll bet you it's psychological. I'm with the men and women who made my favorite radio show, in fact, my favorite broadcasting enterprise, which was Monitor. Their names are Cappy Petrasch, Charles Garmett, Bud Drake, and Steve White. What a fitting moment, as my voice is unable even to mount an honest question. What a moment to invite you to go ahead and reminisce.
Well, you want to pick it up?
But about,
no, we, like a Quaker prayer meeting. Whoever feels moved, just
well,
talk.
We can talk about it. You mentioned Miss Monitor. I guess we're going to talk with her later, Teddy Thurman.
Right.
And that brings the sound of the Southland to us, because that's what she came from. But I was thinking about Harry Golden, one of the people that you work with, Bud.
Well, Harry Golden was brought to us by an ad agency in town because they wanted him to sell a certain brand of gefilte fish, and I've forgotten what the brand was. But anyway, he was brought into the studio, and they said to me, now, Harry is a writer and not a talker, and you have to get a performance out of him. So I sat down with Harry, and he gave me this rabbinical lilt to his to his style. It was, I thought, lovely, but he was so embarrassed that he couldn't deliver with the round tones that he thought radio ought to be delivered in. And I noticed that every once in a while, he'd get up and go into the airlock.
And then what's an airlock?
Well, an airlock is the space between the control room and the studio that isolates sound so that sounds from one don't leak into the other. And he would disappear into the airlock, and then he'd come back to the studio, and he'd sit down, and he'd be 50% better than he was before he went into the airlock. He'd do another spot for me, and he'd say, how was that? And I'd say, fine, and he'd get up and disappear into the airlock. And he'd come back, sit down, and do another spot. And this was maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Harry, I hope you're listening. It took me the longest while, I guess I was slow, to realize that Harry loved bourbon. And he was disappearing into the airlock and ashamed to admit to me that he needed to loosen his vocal cords. And finally, when I realized what was going on, I said, Harry, please, my friend, sit here and enjoy your bourbon right on the table. And he did, and we got
known as the Golden Glow.
The best car on the road needs a little lubrication.
Right. When the show was 10 years old, Barry, we had a party in the skating rink at Rockefeller Center.
Oh, so yeah.
1965.
June 12th, right?
Yes.
Count Basie's orchestra. And we had a lot of invited guests. Of course, the staff of the show was there, and it was quite an event. And one of the little gimmicks that we pulled off that weekend was kind of reminiscent of when the show first went on the air. We flew in Sammy Kahn, the lyricist, and his sidekick, Jimmy Van Heusen, who with both the words and the music of all three and four Academy Award winners. And their assignment, we put them in Radio Central with an upright piano. Right while the show was going on the air, the communicators were there, and they were more or less right behind the glass that you saw when you came on the tour. And their assignment was to start on Saturday morning to write a birthday song for Monitor. And they had until Sunday night to finish it. And we arranged for Steve Lawrence to come in and a few fellows from the house band to play it. And as the show progressed throughout the whole weekend, we'd keep cutting back to them. How you doing, Sammy? And Sammy would say, well, we're up to this part. Let's give them a little of this. And sure enough, by Sunday night, they had a very cute song.
Unmemorable.
And that song today is Willy Nelly Baby.
Which did not win an Academy Award.
But again, it was part of the idea of things that we did. We tried to use quality people and come up with some sort of a, if possible, a pleasant idea and come off. And that was in the midst of everything else that was going on.
Well, we used so much material each weekend.
Yeah.
For 40 hours on a weekend, you'd use 40, 50, what we call spots, interviews, remotes, whatever they were. And I think in a couple of years, you'd end up interviewing almost everybody for the fifth or sixth time, so you'd have to be a little bit more inventive. And people really began to feel doing a Monitor interview is like visiting an old pal, you know, when they came to New York. I know Marlena Dietrich did a whole series of what I guess.
Well, she started out doing some interviews, and then she ended up as one of the Monitor regulars. I remember it was
started kind of a Dear Abby or a
we had these
letters.
Little cavern-like offices on the fourth floor, and I went into my office one morning and saw what looked like a fairly mature or not quite elderly woman, but with a bandana on her head, no makeup, just busily typing something in one of the typewriters. And she looked vaguely familiar, and I had no idea who it was. And I walked out, and I walked about, you know, 8 feet into the triple take of all time, because this was the great Marlene Dietrich, who had come in to give advice to the lovelorn and how to cook and how to be, in those days before women's lib, how to be a good wife. There's nothing wrong with that even now. But it was startling to have somebody, you know, of what. We're not that awestruck by big names, but she was one of the super people, not like today's superstars who get one hit record and now here he is, Fred Superstar. These were very, very big, talented people, and they were part of our regular show. And it was kind of a tremendous kick to find that every week.
I thought that was a classy idea. I really did. I mean, if you're going to have somebody give advice to the lovelorn, who better than Marlene Dietrich?
Mm-hmm.
So then we had Sir John Gielgud giving Shakespeare lessons to Joe Garagiola. I mean, it's just lovely. Lovely stuff.
Yeah, you know, the whole sports scene. We used to cover live, you know, the horse races, not the Derby because some other network had that, but we'd cover races every week from New Orleans or from Hollywood Park, trotting races, anything that we could cover in. Or even continuing things, we could run through the day and pick it up as it went. That was before the days of delayed broadcasts. You just kept going, and if people stayed with you or came back, they could follow a marathon race they liked, and we'd give you the end 3 hours later. And that's constantly pouring out everything that was going on in every possible way. Really, you know, you felt you were doing something that was worthwhile for you.
And there were a whole series of parties that Monty used to go to whenever there was a big party,
yeah,
for an opening or backstage or a theater.
Yeah, we did the New York Film Critics Award 1 year, and I had the great pleasure. I made it my personal chore to keep my hand on Deborah Carr so she wouldn't get too far away when we needed her to do the interview. She had won a prize that year up at Sardi's. It wasn't just work. It was a personal kick every time. You did the job, but you were doing something with all sorts of talented people.
Excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
We did have a lot of fun, of course, but we also, I thought, had some very moving and very touching moments on the show.
We did.
One point, I was doing a three-hour segment with Frank McGee as my host, and it was a complete news resume of the week's news. And we had so many interesting guests, and one in particular that I remember was Martin Luther King. And at the very end of the interview, Frank said to him, Dr. King, I know your home has been threatened with bombs. I know your life has been threatened. How do you cope with this inside yourself? And Dr. King said, if I have to give up my life, I'm paraphrasing this, of course, to free my children and the children of my brothers from a slavery that is worse than death, then that's a sacrifice that I have to make. And now I'm almost paraphrasing him exactly. He said, I feel if a man has not found something worth dying for, he hasn't lived. And I have never forgotten it.
Yeah, and along the lines of moving and tragic things, when President Kennedy was assassinated. Of course, we went off the air. That was on a Friday, so we didn't broadcast on Saturday. But as soon as this happened, we had a meeting, and we then went to work, and we did a 3 or 4 hour tribute to President Kennedy on Sunday evening. And, I mean, everybody really just stayed there. We didn't go home. We cut everything we could get out of the files. We got everybody we could, you know, interviewed. And I think we felt that we'd done something, you know, in addition to entertaining people throughout the years, we'd done something worthwhile. And these are memories that you don't just ever forget.
I'm responding to Semaphore from our control room. Leo, are you signaling me that we have this monitor? Teddy Thurman.
Oh, terrific.
I haven't spoken there for a while.
While we make sure that the connection is sound, can we adjourn for our normal interval right now? Make sure we don't lose Miss Monitor, or I'll lose my temper, even if I have to regain my voice to lose my temper. I'm Barry Farber. Leo Lowndes tells me that Miss Monitor, Teddy Thurman, is on our beeper phone. Teddy, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
If so, you're better than I am, because I can't hear myself.
Well, you sound
is that beeper working? I feel like Bob and Ray again. Teddy, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Somebody who has a voice asked
Teddy.
Teddy.
Who's that? Is that Kathy?
Bill, we're not connected. Is there anything you can push? Leo's talking to her happily ever after. Is there any way we can connect, you know, like radio does now and then?
Well, do you hear me?
Leo, keep Teddy on the line. We never advertised ourselves for our electronic wizardry. We do have Miss Monitor. We do have a beeper hookup, and we're going to cross-fertilize the two before we part.
Well, you heard what Bob and Ray said earlier. Yeah. When we used to break down on the air.
All we need is Bob
they
and Ray.
They filled. Now we'll fill.
Yeah, but I never heard what I thought was a mistake on Monitor. Did you?
There were no mistakes as such because...
It just gave you a chance to do something extra.
You knew what was happening then, and it was accepted that you didn't have to be, you know, plastic perfect, which is what we are nowadays. Everything must be shaped and checked and gone over and put down on tape so that it gets to be inhuman after a while. And if we had a goof, we had very, very able people. Our communicators could talk their way... I think you would have been a marvelous communicator because you have the facility to talk. But they could talk their way out of anything. Then they had people standing by to help out. And we mentioned a few of them, but there were some of that. I don't know how we haven't gotten to it. Gene Rayburn, many years with us. Wonderful,
Ed McMahon.
All around. Ed McMahon.
Of course.
Henry Morgan, the great... He was one of our hosts for many years, and he added his own style to... You see, the great thing about the show was that the show was always a star. It didn't matter whether it was Garraway or Henry Morgan or, you know, even or Brinkley. The show was a star, and the communicator, whoever he was, as important as he was a co-star. And he gave his own flavor to that part of the show, but the show was always in command.
All engulfing.
It was Monitor, and you were a communicator, and it didn't matter how important you were. When you were there, you were working with Monitor. Not servient to it, but you were working with it. And you think Teddy's on?
Let's try it again.
Ask her.
Teddy!
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, there she is.
Yes.
Explain to her.
Listening to you, and it was very interesting. I loved everything enough.
Explain to her that I want to talk to her for a minute, but I got a bad voice. Tell her.
Can you hear that, Teddy? Barry has a terrible laryngitis attack and can't talk very well.
And Teddy...
Oh, you're making me homesick.
How are you, baby?
Fine.
This is Bud Drake.
Well, Bud, how are you?
I'm just fine.
Kathy? Oh, it sounds great to hear you.
Steve is here. Cappy Petrasch, Charlie Garman.
Oh, great, Cappy and Charlie.
Listen, we were talking about how great you were, you know, during your weather. Do you think you might remember, could you give us a sample of what you used to do for us?
Yeah, this had some lush background music.
Yeah.
This was, again, a signature monitor. We had communicators, and we had the weather, the temperatures given as they were never given before. Some very strong Nelson Riddle, very smooth, lush strings, and then the voice would come out and tell you about...
Where are you, Teddy?
Do it, Teddy.
Right here.
How about a temperature in Spokane?
Oh, in Spokane. It's bigger than Spokane in New York. Temperature is 56.
56 and cloudy. And
very cold and dry, you know.
Sounds like a martini.
Kind of weather, a dry Manhattan. A Manhattan, my dear, I miss it. How is it? It sounds great.
Teddy, I'm going to try to make myself heard to you. This is Barry Farburn. It's been my dream since I first heard you to talk to you, and it's a bad time to practice it. Can you hear anything I'm saying at all?
Yes, I'm interested in your dreams now.
All right.
More about that.
Okay. I had a lot of fantasies about you.
Oh, sounds good. Let's hear more.
No, don't get angry. Not that kind of fantasy.
I'm not angry. I'm thrilled. What is it?
As I used to hear you on Monitor, I used to fantasize that you would one day come on and say, Gaffney, South Carolina, 88 and muggy. Charlottesville, Virginia, 65 and tacky. Yadkinville, 91 and slimy. Places that I knew, but you were always into Philadelphia and New York and Los Angeles and San Diego and even Stockholm and Copenhagen.
Oh.
All the glamorous places. You never got down to where I was listening to you.
Oh, well, in Chile, it's con carne.
You know, I crept up to the fifth floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza to look at you.
Uh-oh.
And I saw you there, and I thought it was a trick. I thought they hired a good-looking redhead to sit there for the tourists.
And they tried to hide me.
Yeah, no, I thought that backstage there was the real Teddy Thurman with the real voice that nobody could see, just, you know, giving the voice effect. But did they hire you to sit as a front person out front just to look the part?
That's funny. Oh, well, it was fun. My God, it was fun. It was terrific. And the whole show, everything about it was one of the greatest things in the world, I think.
When you go to parties now and introduce yourself not as Miss Monitor but Teddy Thurman, do people still make the connection and snap their fingers and like Steve White and Cappy Petrasch and Bud Drake and Charles Garment, do they make you do the whole thing all over again?
Oh, well, sometimes it's very funny. I was at a party at Patsy Kelly's. Do you know her?
Yeah.
She's and Irene, they're out here. And I was at the party they gave there. And they asked me to do the weather report, a la Miss Monitor. And I really got more of a people knowing about it than I expected. It was terrific. I really got a great hand. And, you know, it was fun.
Teddy, who were the monitor hosts that you were working with? We were trying to think of, you know, all the people who've done the show. Maybe you can come up with some names we missed.
Oh, great. There's, of course, Dave Garraway and Hugh Down, Frank Blair, Monty Hall.
How much time did you spend in the studio? Because you were doing all that weather live, of course.
Yes.
And you were doing it while we ran for 40 hours, right?
Right. I ran through the whole weekend. At first, I was going on all night until Mr. Weaver called up and said, she sounds tired, let her go home. And the first weekend, we did go 40 hours. I think I just took a few hours off, but then we managed to get through traffic control and see which was best hours to be on most, you know, and work it out. And then we still ran all weekend, as you know, and all night, but I took off usually about midnight, I think, and then got back about 10 in the morning.
And she had a long day.
Well, you were in the studio, I guess, when Bob and Ray were there doing their stuff live, too, right?
Oh, yes. They worked in the same studio, and they were wonderful. You know, the funny thing, they used to pull jokes on me, and it made it real lively, kept us up. And they were very funny to be there with all the time. And another one that was funny was Henry Morgan. One day, he suddenly got the inspiration to set my weather report on fire from the bottom up. Farther down, I read the less I had to read, and I had to start making it up as I was going. And he was beating the flames out. It was really torrid.
I was going to ask you, you know, I sometimes thought you did make that weather up. I guess you can't do that anymore, but...
Oh, no. Never made it up except that time when it was on fire. But...
Dear Henry.
The reports from Washington. First, the newsroom used to get them for me. You know, they were right adjoining us. And they used to get them. And then it worked out better for me to get it direct from Washington because I could tell how much time I had and about what cities to give at the right times and things like that.
Teddy, whose idea was that voice of yours?
Well, I guess... maybe Mama and Daddy. I don't know. I had this kind of voice since I was a kid, but the idea of using it that way, I think, came from Mike Zima, who was writing and directing there.
That's right.
He was the first one who contacted me. He used to be a director for Steve Allen. And...
Yeah, Mike worked with Arthur Godfrey, too, I remember.
One of the original writers and directors there.
Teddy, can you remember any of the funny spots in the show? We were talking before about interviewing snake catchers and 77-year-old men who live at the mouth of the Amazon. All those are my kind of favorite spots. I wondered about any that you might remember.
Well, we had some Lulus. I remember the man that... what did he write? The funny one that had the sandals on and the robe. The Nature Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Singer.
What was his name? Hey, Ross Bagsadarian.
No.
Not him?
He was for real, the way he dressed, and those old sack-like clothes and sandals. And long. He was the original hippie, I guess. I'd never seen one like that before. A long beard. And then there was another funny woman that... no lady that lives in the Waldorf Towers that recorded for Harbor Records for her. She had this crazy, wild voice.
Oh, yeah, the one who was always off key.
Used to give concerts,
right?
Okay.
We had her on several times. she managed to get a lot of reaction, I think. Let's see.
Barry, are you able to talk yet, Barry? Looks
no.
Still,
no,
laryngitis
no.
is bringing him down.
I have accommodated laryngitis before. I've never really cursed it like I'm doing it right now, because I have so much to say.
Well, it sounds good, just
the same.
Well, they had so much good to say that it wore your voice out.
Teddy, if good fortune ever brings you within easy range of these microphones, please find a way of letting me know, because I'd like to do this all over again and at close range.
Oh, I would love to do it.
Meanwhile, thanks very much for joining us on the telephone, and I hope your weather is always at the climate that you prefer.
Well, the same to you, and I enjoyed it very much, and I hope your laryngitis is completely over tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Teddy Thurman, Miss Monitor herself, I couldn't believe that they actually had the Miss Monitor that I saw. I thought she was a studio prop, a front. And I tell you something, I would have excused them if they did, because she was so striking to look at. And to think that the voice actually matched. I'm proud and happy to be sitting across the microphone from the men and women who made Monitor: Cappy Petrasch, Charles Garmett, Bud Drake, and Steve White. We were talking about some of the landmarks, some of the intersections that made Monitor. And incidentally, my voice is now no longer gone. It's officially gone and can't be. Since it's been confirmed and certified and hogtied and branded, may I just deputize you as my surrogate now for you to proceed through what you know we still have in our bag of tricks about the show that we will always love and revere, namely your Monitor.
Well, we brought in a batch of tapes that we kind of... really enjoyed on the show, and I think one thing we always did very well, from Bangkok to Brooklyn, we would find some of the best animals to interview, or at least their owners to interview. And way back about 10 years ago, we did an interview with a minor bird called Winston Churchill Mulholland, who was terrific. But we since came up with a minor bird that we really think is just about the best in the business. But I think you were at that session, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. And this bird talks more clearly than any bird I've ever heard. And at the end of this cut...
More clearly than I.
I'm afraid. And at the end of this cut, you're going to hear the bird try to imitate the monitor beeper. So let's hear the cut.
Want a kiss? Little cookie girl, I'm a pretty boy. I'm a pretty boy.
The last bit was his version of the beeper, and they'd taken his trainer and got him across the room. It was not, no ventriloquism involved. This bird was spooky.
I remember the day that we brought in a gal who was billed as an electric snake dancer. And she came in to the studio just to do the interview, but she brought in a big basket with her, carrying this basket, and in the basket is some kind of a big snake.
It was a
and
it was,
we didn't know she was going to bring
about
it.
Six to eight feet long. And I think Gene Rayburn.
Gene was doing the interview.
Brave now, man.
It's the same scene. You're sitting where Gene is. The girl is sitting over here, and she's got the snake in the bag, and the snake starts to come out of the bag and squirm around Gene's
around the mic.
It
was a beautiful scene.
And Gene sees this thing and starts to back off. By then, the control room had filled up with 9 million people. It was really a funny scene. Of course, nothing happened. She put the snake back in the basket.
No, he actually handled the snake. He put it on his neck. He came on very bravely. Gave him some kind of a cup of coffee as a distinguished service medal.
We had a kangaroo in about a couple of weeks ago.
I think we never worried about the fact that the show was radio, and that you couldn't see people.
People's imaginations.
We've had belly dancing lessons and wrestling lessons, and I think.
Oh yeah, we'd get people in on a tour. If we had a square dance called the interview, we would have them do a square dance. Get 35 people in here.
Well, I think for a show to stay on for 20 years, you have to do something right, and I think one of the big pluses was that nobody really knew what to expect. You know, it wouldn't be a boring kind of
including us. There were many times we weren't sure.
Mm-hmm.
But that was basically why the show, I think, had its initial impact, was that old-time radio was in blocks of 15 minutes and a half hour, an hour, and you knew what you had, and if you didn't like it, you just left. But when they came up with mono, they came up with the idea that you turn on, you heard the beep, and you knew after that you'd get a couple of minutes of something, and if that wasn't your dish, something would follow, which would be totally different. And we went on and on and on, and we amazed ourselves sometimes. And we hit a lot of, we hit down spots, but we did have that marvelous thing known as suspense. You didn't know what was coming up, and
I think another team that people talk to you about, if you meet them and you say you work on Monitor, and they mention Nichols and
Moody. Yeah.
And I think, Bud, you ought to lead us into this next cut because you're actually on it.
Maybe we should say it's Mike Nichols and Elaine May. Mm-hmm. You know?
Who have now gone on to other kinds of glory.
Exactly.
Well, they really were the most intelligent comedians I ever
knew. Bob and Ray will resent that. Bob and Ray were equally the most intelligent.
All right. But they really brought a quality of cerebral reflection to their comedy that was rare. And the way that I used to work with them was go in the studio, and I used to book 3 hours at a time, and they would come in, and they would just simply start telling jokes to each other. And then they would dramatize a joke, and then all of a sudden a spot might come out of it.
Yeah.
And I had one engineer and one sound man, and sometimes the sound man would make no contribution to the spot. The one that we're going to hear, there was no sound at all. It was just two people talking. But Mike and Elaine enjoyed each other so much that they would absolutely fracture each other in the studio. And one of my difficult chores was to try and select from what they were doing in the studio material that did not have laughter going on underneath it at the same time that they were performing it.
They broke up enough.
And they were such purists that once they had delivered a line for me with the feeling and intensity and quality that they wanted it to have, they wouldn't give me a take two. So I had to live with whatever they gave me. Now, the track that we're going to hear is an example of Nichols and May at work. And you're going to hear me say to them something about, why don't we do a doctor spot? And they take off from there. Let's hear it.
Can we do a doctor spot?
Well, you can't do anything funny about doctors.
What happened to it? There's a whole spot there.
Well, that's something funny about that. All right, we'll improvise something funny about Nichols and May at this point.
Ready to go now?
Broke.
Something had, well, again.
Down the drain. This what a shame.
This is called live radio.
Again, we need Bob and Ray to
Well, we may have a backstop on it. We don't have Nichols and May, but we did have somebody else.
Look, the intestines of that cartridge are hanging out.
Well, that's modern
radio.
Go
ahead, rewind it.
It may not work.
Well, you know what? Unless your engineer is too busy trying to fix up that tape, we also brought...
We'll mention his name.
A classic, no.
No.
A classic tape that we've played at every Monitor Christmas party. You know, to get perfection on radio, very often you have to do a lot of discrete editing. And this is one of our favorite fluff tapes. You know, it's just...
Well, Bud worked with us. You want to explain what the series... It was a series of...
I keep ending up telling the stories.
Be tentative, you know. You never know whether we're going to hear it or not.
It's suspense again. This is Monitor, the old Monitor. We don't know where we're going, but something will happen.
It happened at this particular point in the history of the show that I was doing a special project, so that all the entertainment, all the comedy spots, and that kind of thing was
my
province.
That's right, Bud. We know you're hogging the program.
And this particular gentleman wanted to be a performer, but he really didn't have the equipment. And he just had difficulty really saying his name without stumbling over it. And I would take his tapes into the edit room, and we would pull out take 1, 2, 3, 4, of one line and finally find the line that he had said correctly, start with that, and then go on to one line, and he'd fumble again. So one day the engineer said to me, why don't we just tie all the outtakes together and see if it makes any sense or what it sounds like. Now, I don't know whether this is as funny to outsiders as it is to people in the business, but here's what it sounded like.
The captain ordered the canvas prepared. That night, the sailors spread it on deck. The child was placed in it. Then it was folded over a body and sewn up ready for burial, and then sewn up ready for burial the next day. But even as they did so, everybody heard the... Sorry. In 1683, she married King Louis XIV, and for the remaining 32 years of his reign, it was Francois who guided... In 1683... She married King Louis XIV, and for the remaining 32 years of his reign, it was Francois who guided the destiny of France. In 1683, she married King Louis XIV, and for the remaining 32 years... Oh, Christ. In 1817, he fell in love with that he had heard Emily. He had complained either he marry his daughter he would challenge him to a duel. The opponent had changed of heart, too. And he hoped his... And two shots rang out. Adolf fired high, but even... Two shots rang out. For the rest of his life, nothing could alter his feeling of guilt that his curse was the cause of the tragedy. When he died, he left all his money, $5 million, to be divided equally among the survivors of that terrible tragedy. For the rest of his life... I thought of modern atomic submarines and then of the Roman Empire and how they conquered Carthage, which we now know as Tunis. In the year 260 BC, Cyrus Deulius was consul of Rome. In the year, he could hardly ask for his bodyguards before they had a chance to allot him another flute player and a torchbearer for being the conqueror of the Carthaginians. He told them that someday right where they were standing, he told them that someday right there where we... Soon afterward, John Hendricks died.
I feel better already.
Beautiful.
We hope he forgives us.
Our apologies.
We won't mention his name, but this is what, it's therapeutic. Yep. When you do a show, you need something to break you up completely once in a while, and it never fails.
Mm-hmm.
But well, we didn't have to put everything on a tape and cut it. We don't have the other thing, do we?
I guess not.
No. Can't you put that back together?
We're trying.
I have a legitimate filler piece right here. Will the young man named Ken, I don't know his last name and I shouldn't give it anyhow, will the young man named Ken, who used to work for Monitor, who called Leo Lowndes in our control room a short time ago, please call her again at the same number right now? I would repeat, but doctors have been calling up saying I'm an idiot to be talking this much. Any shirt tails left to be tucked in? This will not be the last that we will discuss. This will not be the last discussion we'll ever have. I don't mean to sound like the gentleman whose outtakes you just played. Incidentally, just for fear that somebody will not realize what has just been heard, will somebody again, a little bit more patiently and slowly, explain what outtakes are? Because most people in everyday life don't have outtakes.
Well, it's the kind of thing when we're recording, and we're taping, and as you heard, with this personality, he had to repeat certain things. Now, in putting the show together, we of course only use the good stuff, and the other material is left out, so that becomes the outtake. And when some of them are funny, we kind of save them. And as Cappy pointed out, Monitor's had a Christmas party in our office, and since the show has been on almost 20 years, we've also had a couple of retirement parties for some of our staff people. And when Monitor has a retirement party, we go all out. We get reports from people like Mr. Garraway.
When Parker Gibbs retired, Parker was one of our directors, and he had been with the old Ted Weems band. It was the man who sang, if you remember the song, Piccolo Pete, and some small fame. And he had worked with Perry Como when Perry was on the Ted Weems band. He also worked with Garraway in Chicago. He was Garraway's first producer and director. And so when Parker went, naturally doing Monitor, we always went around the world. We just got in touch with everybody who had worked with him, and we got Perry in Florida and Garraway in Boston, wherever he was, and somebody in Spain. I forget who was in Spain. I think it was one of the announcers. Fred Collins.
Right, that's right.
And we produced, again, the same feeling of the Monitor feeling of fun and serious material, music. They, you know, scored an entire production for him. But the amazing thing was that, well, I guess it's not amazing when people are that work that closely together on something they enjoy for a number of years, you get a very, very strong family feeling. And I really feel that there was less rancor, less backbiting. You know what shows are like and what any business is like. There was really a very strong feeling of working together and having a marvelous time doing what we felt was a worthwhile, entertaining show. And it hung on. You said earlier today, Bud.
Well, really, I agree. When you spend 8 to 10 hours a day with a group of people under very trying, pressurized circumstances where everybody has a job to do and darn well better know what his job is, and it all has to dovetail together, and we've been together for close to 20 years, we have literally gone through death and through birth together. We've gone through marriages, we've gone through divorces. I'm the sentimentalist of the group, you might gather. We've gone through broken hearts, we've gone through wars, and we do have an unbelievable feeling of closeness for each other. We spend almost more time together than we do with our husbands and wives.
And you know, I think that feeling really extends to all the reporters who've worked on the show through the years. I remember what some of the guys, you know, basically the fee for, this is tapes now, of course we did lots of live remotes, but a good portion of the show developed into taped interviews. And we'd have people really literally working 10 hours to arrange an interview that paid them all of $33.60. And people would go into swimming pools and find somebody there with a Monitor microphone. I remember Dale Remington, who was particularly ingenious, was in England, and he thought he would get the sounds of the changing of the guard. So as they were marching along, he ran in with his microphone sort of at the guardsman's feet and was practically deported from the country. But this is the kind of devotion that, you know, we got from our guys. And I think that's what made the spots. There was a woman reporter who drew, I forget her name, thick Southern accent, who got us a great, she went out with the Revenuers and got us a great tape of their blowing up a still. And this kind of thing, you still don't see television. Nobody can really afford the time or the money for just a cutesy spot.
A couple of years back, New Year's Eve came on a Sunday night when Monitor was on the air, and we did an open line with the BBC because we went on the air at 7 o'clock New York time, and it had already been midnight in London, and the quality of the line was so good that the two guys in London sounded better than our guy here in Radio Central. But we kept that up for an hour, and it gave, again, some live excitement to the whole evening.
I wish we had more time. I wish I had at least some voice. I hope I have enough to express a concluding feeling right here. We may have time to weasel in one more Bob and Ray thing here. But while I still have you 3 feet away with no double plate glass in between, may I just congratulate you on what you did achieve, and may I point out that a lot of people whose broadcasting endeavors are no longer ongoing, they have the consolation that their work will be remembered. You have a much higher consolation. Your work will be a lot more than remembered. It will ricochet, and it will continue to reverberate, and not just with me. thank you very much for coming. Steve White, Bud Drake, Charles Garmett, and Cappy Petrash, the men and women who made Monitor, not just NBC Monitor, but a voice of America that will continue to not just echo, but ricochet and reverberate.